show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past.
It's a place where I met my wife and my three children were born. And to this day, I'm so proud to call KC home.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's present.
Alex with a basket catch. They're going to send the runner. His throw, a great one! Alex Gordon with a tremendous Gold Glove play.
And a show that looks at Kansas City baseball's future.
With the fifth selection of the 2012 first-year player draft, the Kansas City Royals select Kyle Zimmer.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
I'm joined by Michael Engel. Jeff Herr, man, he is just a bum. He's not here again this week. He's really tied up with some things. And
I think he had piano lessons this week.
I feel his pain because I understand.
Maybe a ballet lesson.
I can tell. I understand his pain. I am definitely wrong. It was a long. And so we talked with Kurt Nelson of the Kansas City Royals Hall of Fame, and he's a great guy, and he loves to talk. He warned us off the air. He says he's a bit of a windbag, so I guess he fits in with the rest of us around here. Sure. Mike, not a very big week in baseball. The biggest news, of course, is Johnny Giovitella sent to AAA. It locks the second base job for Chris Getz. It brings Elliot Johnson into that. It appears that he'll be that utility guy that he told us he would be when we talked to him earlier this year on this show. And then Miguel Tejada still not added to the 40-man. So what's your takeaways this week on – I know – well, let's just start with this. How frustrated are you that Johnny Giovitella didn't get that job?
I mean, you knew going in that Chris Getz was the guy, that was who they felt was in the lead for the second base job. And to his credit, I mean, he has good numbers. I mean, he's gotten on base. He's hitting the ball. He's doing all that stuff. And Giovitella hasn't outperformed him. So, yeah, it's frustrating, but I get it. I still think that it's the wrong way to go because, you know, Chris Getz, we know exactly who Chris Getz is. You know, his ceiling is what he did last year when he was still below average. So, you know, when you get a chance to figure out what Johnny Giovitella is as a big leaguer, I really think you should do that because you've got pretty similar production. I mean, even doing poorly, he's not going to do much worse than Getz. I mean, he just isn't. So you still have the upside, though, if he does figure it out, if he gets his confidence, if he gets settled at the plate, if everything's healthy, seeing the ball well, all that. If it comes together, you got a pretty good hitter at second base. It's a position that, you know, they don't really expect that much out of, obviously, if they're going with Chris Getz. So whatever you get that's a surplus on what Chris Getz can do is a complete bonus. And Giovitella has that potential, I think. And, you know, they're no closer to figuring out what he is as a big leaguer than they were 2 years ago. And that's really the main problem. It's similar to, like, their handling of Keila Kaiahui, who in 2008 hit everything out of the park in the minors. He got a cup of coffee in the majors, spent about 2 weeks in the majors. And then in 2009, they never even looked at him. They kept him in the minor leagues. And then finally in 2010, he got a little bit of time. And then it was finally 2011, you know, they take a look at him, and at that point, they finally realize, okay, this guy can't do it. You know, they wasted 2009, 2010, and 2011 when they could have figured it out in 2009 that he wasn't going to be a capable big leaguer. And, you know, even let's say Johnny Giovitella is a bust. Wouldn't you rather figure that out in 2012 and 2013 than have to come to that realization 2014 and 15 when it might actually matter?
Right, with that window of opportunity closing around him. So you, right. You're saying that sending Johnny Giovitella makes you feel down to AAA makes you feel this way?
Whatever.
That's stupid.
Screw that.
Why would anybody do that?
So that's pretty much Michael Engel's opinion on Johnny G. Vitello move.
That's exactly it. I mean, and I've gone round and round. I mean, this is the second, third year where this has come up where, you know, you start fighting about, oh, is Johnny G. Vitello good enough? Well, look at his minor league numbers. Yeah, they are minor league numbers, but they've shown, you know, he's shown every single level, and as he's advanced, that he can do it. And I just don't think the Royals have committed enough to seeing what he can do. He hasn't even played 100 games at the major league level. You know, if you can judge a guy in 99 games and call him a big leaguer or not, congratulations. I just don't think they've given him a fair shake at any point. And, you know, they're kind of going with the safe choice, and the safe choice often is, you know, you kind of get what you're asking for there.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what becomes of Johnny Vitello. I would like to see what he is. I mean,
right.
We don't know, and that's the worst part of all of it. So I guess we'll find out. But they were right on Kila. We know that much, and I'm not ready to give up on Johnny G. Vitello yet. But I think the most interesting part of this is obviously Elliot Johnson's going to play a utility role, and
yep.
Chris Getz better look out, because if Johnson ever gets the bat figured out, I think he's better than Getz defensively. He's got more flexibility than Getz. He could very easily Uni gets this coming year and slide into that starting role.
Sure.
If he has anything hot. So that'll be interesting to watch as far as Elliot Johnson's concerned. But the bigger story to me, because of, you know, we thought it was such a Royals move, but for whatever reason, Tejada has not been added to the 40-man. Do we think that they might actually cut ties with him?
I don't know. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, they don't really have to make that decision yet. You know, they've got an open spot on the 40-man roster, so they could add him at any time, but you never know. I mean, maybe they get to a point where they can trade somebody and get something good, and you don't want to end up at a point where then you have to go back and try to cut that guy loose. You know, let's say, I don't know if this ever happened, but let's say they add Miguel Tejada right now. They've got a full 40-man roster. And then they make some kind of deal where they bring in a bunch of guys. You know, it's possible. It happens at the end of spring sometimes. You know, you'd have one spot you could open up with Danny Duffy going to the 60-day DL, but then you've got to clear out other spots. And at that point, you're putting players at risk that you could end up losing. And the Royals and most teams, they don't, once they have a player in camp and they have their rights, you know, they're going to manipulate it to the point where they can keep as many of those guys that they feel can contribute, because then you don't want to have to go back later and scramble to try to find these guys, you know, to fill in gaps when you already had somebody there. So he's probably going to be somebody the last few days they add to the 40-man, and then they finally, you know, make him part of the active roster. I think from the start they had the idea that he was going to be, you know, one of their utility guys. I don't know that it's right, but you know, he hasn't fallen apart. And that's pretty much about the only thing he had to do was not fall apart this offseason to keep that job.
They supposedly promised him a spot on the 40-man, and if they did that and then they don't fall through on that, that's going to actually hurt them with other veterans out there. But, I mean, they've always been big about these promises of playing time for veterans.
Right.
And what have you. So
like Melky Cabrera.
Right.
Like
which
that
one worked out okay, you know,
sure.
With all the drugs. So a friend of the program, Lee Warren, talked with Mike Dierschle today, manager of the Omaha Storm Chasers, has been manager there for a long, long time. Now stay tuned to the episode. There's a point where I give out a trivia question. You got to figure that out. I'll tell you, Dierschle's not the answer because he's not a player, but you'll have to find the trivia question later in the episode. But I just thought I'd throw that out there because he's been with the Royals organization a long, long time. Warren said that Dierschle said in an interview that Warren was doing or was part of, that Xavier Nady is expected to report to AAA after he gets well, which means the Royals will owe him a $100,000 roster bonus just for being on the minor league roster. Still, he gets this $100,000, so that shows that the Royals are keeping an eye on him for whatever reason. Along with that, they mentioned Flew being down there. Of course, he's got options, so it makes sense that he'd go back down. Another guy that might deserve a job, but I mean, when you've been a minor leaguer as long as Flew, you kind of have to expect that that's what you're going to get. As long as you have options, that you're going to be kind of batted around, and you are what you are. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I go back to Anthony Sarantelli, who he talked around. He also, Jersey also talked about using him in more of a utility position. So that tells me that the Royals want to take a better look at him as well. And he may get a shot to get to the majors, but it, same kind of thing. You know, you expect if you get the call up, you're going to go back down unless you just go gangbusters, which a guy that's been in the minor leagues as long as Sarantelli and Flew, you're not going to have a breakout that of that kind of sorts. But the Nady thing is very interesting because I think the Royals are starting to doubt how much they can get out of Jeff Francoeur this year.
Well, they definitely have to have options just in case, because there really isn't a very good replacement. I mean, if it comes down to it and they finally have to cut bait after 40, 50 games or whatever, you know, they could get by playing Gerard Dyson in center and Lorenzo Cain in right field as long as everybody's healthy. And I think you could go with that and pretty much stay, you know, afloat for a little bit. But it's not ideal. And if they have other guys who can, you know, show that they're hitting the ball well and they're playing well, you know, you might as well keep them around. You know, it's the same thing going back to, you know, Tejada and the roster, you know, manipulation and things like that. If you can keep them and not have to go seeking out another guy, you might as well keep them. So, you know, $100,000, that's not that much. If he makes the actual big league team, I don't think he's going to make a great deal more than that. He might make around the league minimum. So they're not talking about a lot of money there.
Veteran minimum's around $1 million, I think, so he'd probably get something around there. I'm not going to look it up, but
I mean,
it's something around there.
That's a pittance. That's nothing.
For all the kind of money that comes into this sport, and you look at the collective bargaining agreement and the shared monies that get tossed around,
they are taken care of.
Yeah, it's not a very big deal. On the subject of Francoeur, though, and again, our friend Bill Ivey from I-70 Baseball, he said he read somewhere, he didn't have an exact link for me, but we're going to speculate a little bit on this show, something we don't do a lot of, but there is talk of David DeJesus being traded back to Kansas City to platoon with Jeff Francoeur, and Mike said off the air, he goes, platoon, hell, you know, just give him the starting job.
Just replace him.
He's probably the better player, and then let David Lowe back up, and there you go. But if you were talking to the Cubs, if you were Dayton Moore, what would you be willing to give up to bring DeJesus back, or would you?
Ugh, I don't know. I hate these questions. I hate these questions.
That's why we don't do it. You know, and that's one thing I've always said is the Pinetar Press guys are really good at this stuff. They're really into the what ifs and what have you, and you can definitely find their shows at RoyalsPodcast.com, and they're great. And that's what one thing that's really neat about our two shows is David and Clint are so different than you and I and Jeff are that it makes for two very nice contrasting shows on one subject. But this is definitely something more of their, maybe I'll email into their show and ask them what they would do.
Right.
but I mean, to me, I don't know that I would give much. I mean, I'm not going to give anything that could really impact this team over the next 3 or 4 years because, you know, David DeJesus is not a guy that's going to be long for Kansas City. And, you know, we were all heartbroken when he left because he was a fan favorite. But I think where we're at now as a team is a lot different place than when he left. So other than maybe selling some tickets for some broken hearts from when he left, I don't know what you could really get out of him. I mean, we mentioned off the air, I said if you could trade like Bruce Chen and maybe a minor leaguer of some sort with some upside that you don't foresee being, you know, somebody like Patrick that was traded in the trade to Tampa Bay, that's a guy that has upside but he's a long ways away and may not fit with the mission, you know, I could see doing something like that with the Cubs. But outside of that, I mean, really, is there any point in – because at that point, aren't you just putting bubblegum on a flooding hole?
I don't know. I mean, if it was like a platoon situation, you might go for something like that. But that's a lot of money for a guy who's going to be a part-time player when you've got, you know, $6.5 million or whatever it is for Francoeur, and then you're paying David DeJesus, you know, $4.2 million in that case, and they're both going to be splitting time. You know, that's, you know, $10 million for basically average production, and it's not that efficient. But I guess it's more efficient than paying $6 million and getting below average from Frank Gore. I think he'd be okay. He'd be fine as a platoon guy. There are probably other guys out there, and a couple of the guys at Kings of Kaufman looked at some other options as well that might be out there, and just kind of keeping guys in mind who, you know, are with teams that might have extra outfielders and guys who are out of options who might get placed on waivers. You know, there's not a lot of guys out there. There's a few. You know, guys like Travis Snyder and I think Julio Bourbon is one. You know, these are some guys who are left-handed, who have some experience, who might be options. But it's at this point, it's really tough to tell because the Royals, I think they feel like they're pretty set as far as, you know, who they have on the team right now. And if they really felt like they needed a left-handed guy, they would probably find a way for David Lowe to make the team. And I'm not sure that they're going to do that yet. So it might be something later. It might be depending on, you know, when the final cuts come through here, probably middle of the week, end of the week.
Well, I'll say this. It'll be interesting because I think David Lowe has a really good shot to make this team yet. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with him. But, you know, you're talking about money being wasted, and that's why I kind of brought Bruce Chen up, is because, you know, he's 4.5 this year,
yeah,
which would be, and, you know, is almost the same money as David Jesus, but what does it do for the Cubs? What's the Cubs' advantage of doing that deal unless, again, you get some sort of minor leaguer that helps out them? That's about the only way you could make that work. But it'll be interesting to see, and it'll be something to watch, and it definitely would create a flare in this town with at least the Facebook fans with what's going on, and it'd be interesting to see.
Yeah, I think the Jesus is an example. I think he'd be fine. And from just a fan base perspective, I think that would be kind of cool to get him back, but you can't really tell what the level of production would be, and it's just difficult. Everybody probably wants a cost-controlled left-handed hitting outfielder with some upside, so it makes it difficult to go out and seek them.
So we'll see what happens, but outside of that, was there anything this week that jumped out at you, Mike?
Yeah, I just want so much for actual baseball. I'm tired of qualifying things with, well, it's still spring training, because it gets old. I want real numbers.
Yeah, and I'm definitely ready. I think on that note, let's go ahead and take a break here, and we're going to come right back with an interview with the director of the Hall of Fame, Kurt Nelson, and the director of the Royals Hall of Fame, I should specify that. Not the director of the actual Major League Baseball Hall of Fame, which would be an entirely different interview. But we're gonna go to break, and we're going to come back with that, and then stay tuned. We got some other stuff on the end, so we'll be right back on the other side. All right. That's that.
Woot, woot, woot.
All right. Just we'll stay in touch by email, and we'll figure this out. If you get a chance to get David Lowe an interview, just, you know, Google Voice it, whatever, have him call you and then record it, or I think they have to call you for you to record it. So if you can get him to call you and record it through Google Voice, then do that. Just take advantage of it. And if that looks like that's going to fall into place, then I might call Lee Warren and just do an interview one-on-one with him and continue to try to get Donnie Joseph as an interview. Maybe we can put together, you know, a couple, three interviews. Plus, I have permission to use the 45-minute bit that I was on with the guys from MLB Depth Chart. So I have I have that in the pocket to use if we need to fill, and that's 45 minutes. So that's plenty of an episode if that's where we have to go. Even if we only do, you know, we could even do something where we try to do a three-way call and something like that if we decide not to go with the Blog Talk option. But he's totally cool with us using the Blog Talk option, and then of course it would go up on their site, which is fine. We just make sure to you know, broadcast the KansasCityBaseballVault.com and everything else.
every third sentence.
Yeah, you know, every time you can to get people to come that way, but it'd be in their feed that way and whatever. So that might not be a horrible thing anyways, to do some cross-marketing with another Royals-based Cardinals/Royals based site. So, all right, I got to go. I got to pack. I'm 2 hours behind because of this. So,
fun.
I will. I got to go pick up our money from Kelly's too. I haven't done that yet. And yeah. I'll PayPal you or mail you a check or something here after I get everything settled since cool. We didn't have our. I think Wednesday night, unless something changes, Wednesday I plan on going to Oklahoma Joe's about 7. So if you wanted to come into town and go to that, that's cool. If not, that's cool too, because Lawrence is a long ways away. And so I wouldn't blame you. But yeah, we're going to do that on Wednesday, and then I think we're going to do Hereford House on Thursday, and those are going to be kind of everybody invited type things.
Yeah.
Since we didn't have a going away party. So if you come to either of those, I can hook you up then.
Cool.
But, alrighty. I will talk to you later.
All right. Right on.
Bye.
Hey, Troy, what are you doing this weekend?
I'm going to grab a beer somewhere. What do you have in mind?
I heard about this awesome new bar downtown. It's called Rage. The waitresses have a contest to see who has the most piercing.
Oh, man, that's not really my scene.
Well, there's another bar close by called Spit Cup. Check it out. The bartenders wear chaps, and every hour they shoot a guy.
No, seriously, I just want a bar where I can sit down and watch the game.
Okay, I've got just the place. It's called Lilac. You sit on pillows drink from eucalyptus leaves.
No, Ned, but I just want a place where I can get a cheap drink and watch the football game.
Okay, I got it. This place, it's got a TV. It's called 816.
Lipogetosis.
Yep.
All their drinks come in NBA hats.
Man, I just want a place like Kelly's.
Oh, you mean Kelly's Westport Inn? No, they've got all the basketball and bowl game. They've even got a heated roof. The view is really nice, too, if you know what I'm saying. Why didn't you just say you wanted to go to Kelly's?
Kelly's Westport Inn, 500 Westport Road. Make it your place to go any time of the week.
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault. We're joined right away here by Kurt Nelson, the director of the Royals Hall of Fame. What a neat title that is, Kurt. How does someone become a director of a baseball team Hall of Fame?
You know, you have to be very, very lucky, which I consider myself that. You know, people always ask me, they say, how long have you been with the Royals? And I have to try to explain to them, it's like, well, what do you mean by how long have I been with the Royals? I think most of the time people are asking me when they say that is, how long have you worked for the Royals? And that would be since 1999. But I facetiously, I always, although there is some truth to it, I always tell people I've really been with the Royals since I was born. The Royals were technically born in January of 1968 when the franchise was awarded to Mr. and Mrs. K. And I was born in February of 1968. So I think I pretty much, I say I come with the ball club, and that's certainly been the case. Been a fan since I knew what baseball was, and it's always been an important part of my life and my family. My family were big baseball fans. My parents were from Kansas City. I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, so we were in Oklahoma at the time, but Kansas City was always like my second home, and with the relatives that I had up here, and we used to come up here all the time. So the Royals became my team, and, you know, it was a wonderful time to be a Royals fan, because if you do the math there, you'll figure out that I was about 8 years old when 1976, when we won our first division championship, and then, of course, in 85, I was a senior in high school. So you could really say my entire childhood, it was the time of the Royals having all the championship seasons, and of course that's emblazoned on my mind and in my psyche as a baseball fan. So if you were able to meet the 12-year-old version of me and say, what do you want to do for a living, I would tell you I want to work for the Kansas City Royals. And that's sort of a limiting thing to do, to say to work for one Major League Baseball team. But for me, I've been very fortunate, and that happened. I originally started in the marketing department, but has evolved into this job as director of the Royals Hall of Fame, which I'm very grateful for. It's a wonderful opportunity to be able to talk about Royals baseball, and I have a passion for Royals baseball and Royals history. So that's what I do every day. So who can complain about that, right?
Right. And, you know, for me, you know, I'm a voice. I love having the voice I have. And so, you know, probably my dream job would be doing what Mike does or like Rex or Joel or Ryan, what those guys do. They've got, you know, the greatest job on the planet Earth, because they get to be involved with baseball every day on a radio side or doing the PA or whatever. But you've got a really cool job too. And it really goes unseen, a lot of what you do. But I remember, you were kind of out in front and center through the whole All-Star thing. You were very involved with that, and then even got some news time because they did a story on how when the ball, when one of the home run balls went up and landed on the roof of the Hall of Fame, you climbed up there and got it and had it on display not long after the home run derby ended. It was already there in the Hall of Fame as the ball that landed on the roof. How important is it to you to make sure that you get those little pieces like that? And did you have any trouble keeping that ball? Did Major League Baseball say anything to you about it?
That particular ball, I didn't have any problem keeping. It was sort of mine. The second it landed on top of this building, that was like I knew I had to have that ball, and I was lucky in the sense it stayed up there too. A lot of times that ball might have rolled off, but some of Kansas City's finest were patrolling that particular area, as you would guess, during an event that size like the All-Star Game. So there was a lot of security and Kansas City police that were manning the roof of the Hall of Fame. But I popped my head through the ceiling up there and said, hey, when the ball game or when the home run derby is over, I need to get that baseball right there. So I let them know that I wanted that to make sure that to get that one. So I was able to get that in Major League Baseball. Didn't really interfere with that one at all. It's really kind of, in that particular case, it was harder to get artifacts from the All-Star Game because it's not a Royals event per se. It's a Major League Baseball event, and they have their own protocol for how to acquire artifacts from key moments like that. So I have a few things. I would say that's the most spectacular one of the group. At least that's the one that means the most to me. That ball, that golden ball that landed on top of the roof. So, but it is important, you know. Speaking to it, that was on that was on Monday night. At Home Run Derby, and then Tuesday night of the All-Star Game, when people came back the next day for the All-Star Game, that ball was already on display. And that's really something that I've tried to be able to do, not only in All-Star, we did it for the All-Star Game, but when something happens here at the ballpark. I remember when a couple of years back in 09, when Zach had his 15 strikeout game, we had artifacts from him, the hat, the jersey, and a couple other things on display the very next day. So it's one of those things where to take advantage of that opportunity that's given you by having a facility like this and being able to, if a particular moment in history happens, to be able to bring that into the Hall of Fame and let it be part of the Royals story immediately and bring that to the fans is something that we're always on the lookout to do. So, and it's gratifying when we're able to do it.
Now, don't give the name because we don't want to embarrass any a player if this has ever happened, but have you ever been denied anything from a player?
I haven't really been denied anything from a player. You know, it's one of those things where it's hard to figure out, and it's a little bit different nowadays. Yeah, significant moments for players, like their debuts and things like that, they like to keep something for themselves, and rightly so. It's a key moment. It's a big, huge moment in their personal lives. And, you know, they have many, many people to thank that have helped them along their way. So they want to have things to be able to give to their parents or a high school coach or somebody that's made an impact and has allowed them to be able to reach the heights of getting to the big league. So it is sort of on those sorts of things that are very, very personal. Sometimes it's sort of I wouldn't say it's a negotiation, but it's sort of a discussion with them and club officials to say, you know, what would you like to keep? And then what is there something in there that might be, that the Royals Hall of Fame could have to also share in that particular moment? So we had a lot of guys like the year of the rookie, 2011, a lot of those guys, we have significant items from, you know, Mike Moustakas and Eric Hosmer being the two biggest names in there. I've had the jersey from that game in Anaheim that Mike debuted. And I love it because he's, as we all watch Mike play, and he is the type of player that doesn't mind getting dirty. And it is dirty, and it's never been cleaned, and it's still got that dirt from Anaheim Stadium on it. And then we have batting gloves from Eric Hosmer's first base hit and the cap he was wearing on his debut the night before. And so it's to get those sorts of things and have them here and be able to help tell those stories. And I love artifacts. I like those. If you come into the Royals Hall of Fame, which hopefully many, many Royals fans have done, and if you haven't, please come out and check us out. There's a lot of text and there's a lot of story, which is my want to do, because I'm wanting to tell you as much story as possible. But I also want to try to get over time artifacts, both past and present, to get into the facility, because I think that they humanize the stories and they really bring the stories home. I think if you're able to see the jersey that Mike Moustakas wears, it adds to that story of his major league debut. If I tell you a story about Cookie Rojas, and one of the iconic things about him was that he wore glasses playing second base, and there's a pair of his glasses right there that I can show you. I think that humanizes the story, and you can sort of get the feel for his size or what he looked, you know, that sort of thing. It's the same sort of thing that I always get when I go to other museums like the Smithsonian or something, and walk up to the Smithsonian and there's the battle uniform that George Washington was wearing. It's like right there in front of you, and it really humanizes that. And you know, you can't contextualize in the case of Washington, somebody so long ago that they actually existed, and then there before you is this artifact. So you get a feeling of, oh, he was this tall, and he was. I think artifacts really help that, and inside the museum, it's helpful for us to be able to have those. So the players have been extremely helpful. As is Jeff Davenport, who does manages our travel and our clubhouses, has great relationships with the players to sort of impart on them sometimes the importance of allowing some of those items to become part of the Royals archive, so that because to explain to them that they're part of the ball club's history now, and to be able to be part of that history inside the facility now, so fans can enjoy it as well. So we're always on the lookout to do that. It's harder to do in the past. Try to do it as much as we can. But as we move forward each day, if there's something that's going on, something that might be about to happen or something like that, I'm always mindful about seeing if we can get something and bring it in and help illustrate that story to Royals fans.
Now, before I forget, and I'll try to bring it up again at the end, but one thing that fans may not know is the Hall of Fame is open during the off season, correct?
That is correct.
Hours are you guys there? I mean, obviously we're going into baseball season, but if somebody were to come out during the normal off season, what time are you guys there?
Well, the Hall of Fame is open, and it's primarily, you can see it on its own, but usually for the most part, people, it's part of our tour program. So usually you get a stadium tour, and that includes a stop inside the Royals Hall of Fame. And that's what most people do. They pair them up. And I'm really proud of the tours we give at Kauffman Stadium. I think they go a lot of places that not every ballpark, one, does tours. Two, a lot of times you don't get to go to some of the places you want to go. Our tours almost always will include a trip to the Royals dugout as part of the tour. The only time that doesn't happen is when it's logistically not possible, when there's sometimes another event going on that precludes you from being able to go in there. But we go into other areas of the ballpark that a lot of people don't usually get to see, and we have a great group of tour guides that take you through and really try to engage you in storytelling and tell you about different aspects of the ballpark. And this ballpark's been here for 40 years now. There's a lot of stories to be told, so I'm always really proud of them. But so in the off season, we're technically not open per se, but you can, especially if you have a group, you can call into our tour department, which is Maury Carlson, who heads up our tour department. You can go online and you can get a direct link to him as well, and send him an email. But if you're doing a tour in the off season, primarily with groups, we can do that beforehand, and then we can schedule and have you come out. During this particular off season, we've had a lot of our a lot of Saturdays during the off season, almost all of them. A couple during the holiday season we weren't, but almost every Saturday we were open for tours, and you could actually buy your ticket online. Those tours are going to start happening again as the season starts. Technically, we do open back up for tours as the season begins, and we're open sort of lightly in April. But all those tour dates are available online at the Royals website, and you can see them and order tickets directly there. And then after Memorial Day, we'll sort of be open up every day but Sunday and Monday for tours throughout the most part of the summer, between the summer holidays, between Memorial Day and Labor Day, and then it sort of tapers off down towards the end. But we try to be open all year to give access to people, because There's a lot of people that come in during the, we found out in the off season, especially around the holidays, a lot of people will come into town, people that haven't been here for a long time, or people are having guests in town looking for something to do. And the ballpark is a nice place for them to take someone and learn a little bit about Kansas City and Kansas City baseball history.
Now, I'm curious about the makeup of some of these visitors, because we're at a point now where the Royals haven't been very successful for a while, and, you know, at a certain point, it went from being a very largely Royals town to being mostly a Chiefs town, to where now, is there, do you see more of the older group coming in to see, you know, the artifacts and seeing the exhibits in the museum? Is it a mix of, you know, young and old, or maybe parents bringing in their sons? Or is there any kind of like a generation gap that you've noticed where, you know, younger, you know, say a 15-year-old kid who's only seen the Royals lose, you know, are they as interested in learning about this history as, you know, some other people who might be in into their 30s?
Well, there's a couple of things about that that I find interesting anyway, and there's one has to do with Kansas City baseball history, and one has to do with the Royals being the most recent chapter in Kansas City baseball history. And both of them I find interesting because there is, to a certain extent, a generation gap, as you allude to, from the aspect of there's a generation of Royals fans that don't know the Royals as a winning franchise, or haven't experienced, as I would simply say, haven't experienced a pennant race. And I think that will be a monumentally different experience for a whole generation of people that never lived through one, because I can speak from experience myself about how galvanizing that is towards your feelings, towards the sport in general, and the team that you're following, because I love the NFL, and Kansas City certainly loves the NFL and the Chiefs, but as I explained to people, I'm a big football fan too, but baseball in a pennant race, you think about all the things about football that you like and the anticipation of it, and even playoff football to that certain degree, that's one day a week. I always try to impart to people that haven't really experienced it as a fan being involved in one, is baseball is every day. And when your team is in a pennant race, it is every single day. So the excitement level is enormous, and we haven't done that on the field, and that's the responsibility of us here at the ball club. We have got to, and that's our goal, is to get that back and to get back into pennant races, and hopefully get into the playoffs. So yes, there is a certain amount of that, because when people come in and see artifacts and things dealing with especially the championship years or whatever, it is a lot of older people telling their children about it, and so that's a little bit different in that sense. And we try to tell that entire story, because all the people that were involved in all those championship years, you have to be able to tell their story because of the amazing work that they did in the expansion franchise, and how quickly we were competitive, and then the heartaches and the triumphs and the championships. And in the film, I don't know if you've seen the film in the Royals dugout theater, that really goes through and tells that story, and not shying away from talking about the disappointments even during the championship years of losing to the Yankees, or some of the off-field issues that we have had to deal with as a franchise. So you do see that sort of a generation gap is sort of a learning process, is to tell people the background of Royals history when a lot of the younger folks don't have an affiliation with the Royals during a time of winning, and hopefully that'll change here pretty soon. But they are engaged in it. When people engage them in it, they're interested in that, and sometimes they're surprised by it because they don't really know about it. But so that generation gap might be there a little bit, and it's a sort of a teaching moment. But we also, you know, inside the Royals Hall of Fame, as I was speaking about getting current artifacts and things like that, inside the Royals Hall of Fame, it's really a story of the franchise. So it's not just about the things that have happened before. There's a lot of stuff in here, and we try to keep some of it current with current players, things that have happened in the last year or two, or something that's happened with current players. So it's all about telling that the entirety of the story. So we do want to do that. But the other thing that I find rewarding, and I knew some of this before I took on this job, but the history of baseball in Kansas City that goes all the way back to 1884. It's one of those things where I don't think a lot of people know enough about the great stories that go back. And, you know, the Royals are just the most recent chapter in this history that is, you know, over a century and a quarter now of professional baseball in Kansas City, and the interesting stories and people that have come along. And we try to do that a little bit as well throughout the Hall of Fame. And it's almost an endless supply of things that we could talk about from both in Royals history and all those other teams that came before us. So it's a challenge to have all the stories to tell, and hopefully we'll get around to telling most of them. And that's why we like to have people come out more than once, because we're trying to cycle through quite a bit of things so people can learn so that try to not make it be static. Make it where if you came in at one part of the season and then came in the later part of the season, that there'd be something new for you. And we're always working to try to make sure that happens.
We're talking with Kurt Nelson. We're talking with Kurt Nelson of the Kansas City Royals, director of the Royals Hall of Fame. He's actually staying late at work today to do this interview with us. Of course, when your office is at the K, you really can't go wrong there. Although it's got to be quite something this last couple of weeks where it's been like 70 and everybody's like, yes, it's baseball season. You know, bring it on. We're so ready. And then now this last week we've gotten snow here again, and it's just white out there at the stadium. It's got to be pretty crazy to just look out there and just see that field just snow covered like that.
Yeah, it was, because it started snowing a little bit I was here on Saturday, and the snow was coming down. But last week, the grounds crew had been out. They were aerating, you know, the field. They were mowing it. It was green. It was beautiful. You were looking at it and thinking, oh my gosh, we are really getting close, because the field is starting to look like we could play on it right now. And then, of course, Saturday came along and it's covered. It's all white again. So hopefully this is the last one. I don't know whether anybody can guarantee that, but hopefully this is the last one. And, you know, we're only a couple of weeks out from the home opener now. So, but it's exciting, but it's a little weird today anyway to go out there on this particular Monday, knowing we're 2 weeks out and there's 4 inches of snow everywhere you go. And I don't remember a time, there probably has been, but I don't remember a time where we had that much snow this close to the home opener. It seems a little odd. But we had the 80-degree day not too long ago, so one more of those 80-degree days and this stuff will be gone, and we'll be off and running towards that April 8th date here at Kauffman Stadium.
Yeah, and we got a week to get there. But what I was actually going to ask you, and then we're going to move on to the reason we had you on, of course, is to talk about this year's voting. But I figure we had you on, and you know, like we told you off the air, you know, we've got time, so let's, you know, talk a little bit about the Hall of Fame too. But you mentioned the video, and I have seen that video a couple of times. And how often does that get updated? Do you guys add some newer pieces every year with some of the newer guys and take out guys that aren't with the organization anymore?
I do try to update it every single year. It's usually focused, if you know sort of the time flow of the film, it sort of begins in the current day and ends in the current day and tells you the story of the franchise. And it actually starts sort of like I was speaking earlier about Kansas City baseball history. It begins before the Royals, and it talks Kansas City baseball history, and then it goes into Royals history primarily. So we usually try to change the ending to make sure that it has current day players, because we want current day players to be in it at the end. And of course last year had the All-Star game. So we felt like I really wanted to have a portion of Kansas, sort of a Kansas City focus, albeit very, very brief, but sort of a Kansas Cityans view of the All-Star game experience, at least a tiny bit of that into that final piece of the film to sort of come full circle to be able to get you back through the whole cycle of Royals history. But so yeah, it does get updated every single year. I'm looking forward to the year that I have to go to the powers that be and say, hey, we really need to add in that whole pennant race stuff and change that film quite a bit. So hopefully there's coming a time here pretty soon where I will have the the wonderful problem of having to change the film in a whole fundamental way.
So now, when your job, of course, is to take care of all the artifacts and stuff, but there's also the player aspect of it, and I should have this in front of me, but I believe Mike said we have 25 members of the Kansas City Royals inducted into the Royals Hall of Fame, and of course there's only one Royal in the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame, and that's George Brett. But it's really special that we can honor folks like Splittorff and White and the other greats that have come and gone. And this year, I'm 32, so this year there was a few names on the ballot that really caught my attention. You know, Bo Jackson, because everybody remembers the things Bo did out there on the field and how he made baseball in Kansas City amazing and exciting, and guys like him. And then you look to that ballot and you see some guys that make you go, what is this about? So how does like a Jimmy Gobble and an Emil Brown end up on a ballot that is going to be – that you're going to be able to tweet out? And we all know that folks on Twitter like to have a good time with anything like this. So what's the process for getting on the ballot?
Here's the – and you do make the point, and we've gone through this cycle twice now. In 2011, when Kevin Apier was on the ballot and was voted in and inducted, and then this year, the process was changed. We took a couple of years off while the Hall of Fame, the renovations were going on, and the Hall of Fame, of course, was one portion of that. And then when we came out of that, I went to work with some folks here in the front office and said, what if we really looked at revamping the voting for the Royals Hall of Fame and really set up a full procedure on how it's done? And they were amenable to that. And I said, what I would like to do is I would like to sort of take the National Baseball Hall of Fame model and sort of tweak it around and work on a couple of different things and make it into the Royals model for the Hall of Fame. And that's what we did. So there's two what you would call phases for Hall of Fame voting. One is what I call the regular phase, which is what this year is, and it's what 11 was. And it's player driven. In other words, it's players are on that ballot and really nobody else is. Managers would be on the ballot, but we don't have any that are on the ballot right now. But players are on that ballot, and to sort of like the National Baseball Hall of Fame standard is you got to set eligibility requirements. Eligibility requirements in our particular case, you had to come up with some way of saying, well, how long did they have to be with the Royals to qualify for the ballot? And that had always been before 3 years, but it wasn't really defined much. What does 3 years mean? Does 3 years mean if I played one game in each of three seasons, do I qualify? So then it became – so we kept the 3 years and then three seasons and then added on some other qualifier with stats. And that was – and I decided on plate appearances and innings pitched. And it's a relatively low threshold, 500 – it basically averages out to 500 plate appearances. So it's 1,500 plate appearances or 50 innings or 150 innings for the 3 years. And that's how a lot of those names that would normally you obviously shouldn't receive a vote, I will say that, they should not receive a vote, but they're eligible under the system to be on the ballot. And I always point out, especially because I know how it gets snarky and it's like, how can this person be on the ballot? What's your eligibility is off by these names appearing on the ballot. I always point out that people can't see we don't get the Baseball Hall of Fame ballot. We don't get the ballot that the Baseball Writers Association of America sees. And if you did, you would see that the threshold to be on the National Baseball Hall of Fame ballot is 10 years in the big leagues. Well, 10 years in the big leagues is a tremendous accomplishment for anybody, but there's a lot of guys that are in – that have 10 years in the big leagues that show up on the National Baseball Hall of Fame ballot that we would all say, why is that person on the National Baseball Hall of Fame ballot? They're clearly not worthy of being Hall of Fame, but they are eligible. So they do appear on the ballot. For instance, there were four Royals that appeared on this past year's Hall of Fame ballot. I believe Roberto Hernandez was, Jeff Conine was, Rondell White. Oh, who was the other one? Anyway, so I know those three were. All guys that played 10 years in the big leagues. Once again, a tremendous accomplishment. I wish I had the skill to be able to play in the big leagues for 10 years. But I don't think any of us would say that they're worthy of a Hall of Fame vote. But they appear on the ballot because they were eligible. Now, the Hall of Fame the National Baseball Hall of Fame deals with the entirety of the sport. So they do have a limited selection committee that will go through on first-time eligible players, and they will arbitrarily leave some names off the ballot, although they're still eligible. Because our ballot is small and it's only one team, I don't feel it's necessary or needed for me to make an arbitrary assumption that because someone is eligible, but I don't think they should receive votes, therefore I will not put them on the ballot. I don't think that it should be arbitrary on me to do that once we decided what the criteria were. So that's how you see those names on the list. Now, it's like the National Baseball Hall of Fame vote. If you don't receive a vote, or if you don't receive a certain threshold of the vote, you will not reappear on the ballot. You won't be on it again. And that'll be the case with these guys. You have to get 10% of the vote to stay on the ballot. So obviously those gentlemen that you're speaking of, I find it highly unlikely that they would receive 10% of the vote, so they will not be on the ballot, nor would their names clog up the ballot in future years. But they deserve to be on there in the sense that they are eligible, and that's why they appear on there. So that's the system that we have, and that's how they – now, the interesting thing about our ballot is – it also has names from a long time ago, and you mentioned Bo. And that is because when we changed the system in 2011, there were people that had been receiving votes in prior years under a different system, and I didn't think that it would be right on for me to just say, well, they're done, so they can't be on the new ballot because of the new procedure. So what I did was I grandfathered in anybody who had received two or more votes on any of the three preceding election ballots before the new system. And that's how those guys are still on there. There were a couple more of them that were on in 2011, and they did not receive 10%, so they went off. There's a couple of them, several of them that stayed. You mentioned Bo, Daryl Porter is still on there, Kevin Seitzer is still on there, Al Fitzmaurice is still on there, Al Cowens is still on there, so and John Wathan is still on there. So those are the guys that obviously you can tell by that each one of those guys received at least 10% of the vote in 2011 and have stayed on in 2013. That's the genesis of how that vote started. The other process in the even numbered years, which happened last year in 2012, is there is a Veterans Committee ballot, a Veterans Committee process. That is how George Thoma got into the Royals Hall of Fame last year. It's a little different procedure. It's still subject to a vote. But the ballot is decided by the Royals Hall of Fame Executive Board, which considers the candidacy of certain people, primarily non-field personnel. But we would consider inside of the Veterans Committee players that had received votes in previous cycles but are no longer eligible under that system, and to sort of look at their candidacies again if we felt like at some point that needed to be done. But the executive board decides who goes on the veterans ballot, but then that is subject to a vote, and so they still have to get 75% of the vote at that particular point. Similar system, like I said, to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. I can't remember the numbers. It's a striking number. About 50% of the people in the Hall of Fame, or I'll just say a significant number instead of saying 50% because I don't remember exactly what it is. But a significant percentage of the people in the Baseball Hall of Fame are there through a special election procedure or a Veterans Committee procedure. There's a much smaller group of people that come through what would be the regular phase, the in Kansas City parlance, the George Brett phase of the – that's a subset group of even the subset of Hall of Famers. Those are the very, very select few. And that's the vote that's going on right now. And that's a really tough vote to get because we have a 75% threshold just like the National Baseball Hall of Fame ballot goes. And that's going to be a really hard one to get. And we'll see if we get anyone this year. And then there's the next one in 15 will include someone that I think will have 100, probably close to 100% support in Mike Sweeney. I think he's a, although I, you never say never, but I would be extremely surprised if he wasn't almost a unanimous decision. So I would say in 15, we almost have a definite Royals Hall of Famer. We'll see on this particular ballot. I, you know, I was not to filibuster even more, but when we went through the process, I did explain that there's a couple of different theories that I think general theories you could distill down for Halls of Fame. And one would be the really hard to get into. These are really the top people that really made an impact. A lot of it's numbers driven in that particular case. You really have to have the numbers, and sometimes you have to have the numbers plus. You have to have the numbers plus some sort of other intervening factor. The other thing that I would say is a Hall of Fame of players we really, really like. And there's a lot of those, and so you can have one that's really hard to get into, or one that includes everybody, all the players that everybody really liked, and some of those have really good numbers too, but maybe they don't measure up to the Hall of Fame, the Hall of Fame standard. I'm more one that lies in the idea that it should be very difficult to get in. And that's the system that we have, at least with the regular phase voting. It's a very difficult system to get in. And I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of guys that are going to meet that threshold. The other thing that I would say is, at that particular time is under that particular theory, which I subscribe to, there might be years where you don't have anybody inducted into the Hall of Fame. I don't see that. I don't view that as a problem from a historical standpoint, because I would rather it remain difficult to get in, and therefore the people that get in really reach a threshold that makes them special, really singularly special in the history of the franchise to be able to do that. I think that's the system we have. So I think that's the, you'll see guys like Mike Sweeney get in 2015 because he is a clear runaway. The interesting ones coming up pretty soon, other than some of the guys that are on the ballot now, are guys that sort of their careers work in reverse from what we've been used to in Royals history, and the fact that they began their careers and did a significant portion of their career in Kansas City at the beginning, and then they had the maybe the majority of their career was spent somewhere else, or they became much more famous somewhere else than they, at least nationally, than they were when they were with the Royals. And two obvious cases are Carlos Beltran and Jermaine Dye. And to see how they're going to fit in, so that's a little bit different dynamic than we've had before in Royals history, to look back at the players that are in and see where they're going to measure up. That's going to be an interesting debate when that comes up in a couple of years. If indeed Johnny Damon ever retires, I don't know that he's ever officially going to say that, but, and then Carlos is still playing pretty well, so.
Well, a couple of other names, since you brought up, you know, some of the guys who may have started their careers and then went on to be more, you know, more notoriety with other teams. I'm not as familiar with how the process has gone in the past, but two names that come to mind for me are guys who had very good, you know, seasons with the Royals. One guy, David Cone, just barely qualifies here, I think. But won a Cy Young here, went to Rockhurst. You know, what kind of process has he gone through with all of this? And another guy that gets overlooked a lot and just didn't spend a lot of time here is Danny Tartable, who was, if he'd have spent more time, easily would have had a lot of the great power numbers. But, you know, he's behind almost everybody in plate appearances and in games played. But still up there in home runs and on-base plus slugging and things like that.
Yeah, what's interesting about those two guys is when, like I was saying earlier, when I was going back through when we changed the balloting process and then went back to figure out, okay, who are we going to grandfather in, is to go through the archives and find the tallies for all those particular times and to find that those guys weren't on it. They weren't receiving votes then. So – That's how they did not move into this particular phase. Neither one of those guys had those votes that I was talking about to get me to grandfather into the new system. They're interesting arguments for both of them. I mean, obviously, David had. I think, you know, the interesting thing about David that I don't think a lot of people know is that he only won one Cy Young Award. I think most people would have thought that maybe he won multiple Cy Young Awards. He only won one, and that was here in Kansas City, the team that he's less known for being with. Although in Kansas City, we know him primarily as being a Royal because he was here twice. And we, as Royals fans, we have that connection with him, especially being a hometown kid, which is still a very special thing when he comes back to town. It's like, you know, his family's still here, and I think David still feels a strong connection to Kansas City and his time with the Royals, even though it was really brief the first time and not much longer, a whole lot the second time through. But so his is an interesting case that perhaps, you know, that Veterans Committee might look in the future. Danny's is his is interesting because there's a lot of the numbers are there. I mean, he's got, you know, the hit 300, have more than 30 home runs and drive in 100 runs in a season. Now, those are triple crown numbers that are, you know, that aren't the be all and end all that they were at one time. But if you have a season where you hit 300, have 30 or more home runs and 100 or more RBIs, that's pretty good. And he was able to do that in a Royals uniform. There aren't very many guys that have done that. And he, you know, he had to, I think he's still the only Royal to have a 3-home run game in this ballpark. We've had a couple that have happened, but the other ones that have happened on the road, he's the only one to do it here. So there's some interesting things in his particular case, and maybe that he would be revisited at some point. I would say, and this is an obvious point to make, I think the lack of not playing on a team that made it to the playoffs certainly affects all the view that we all have for all of these players. This would even go to this is even an argument that's had when speaking of the National Baseball Hall of Fame sometimes.
Right.
It's like signature moments. Did he perform in the postseason? Some of these things that are beyond the control to a certain extent of an individual player, but they get sort of, if they don't have it, then it's clearly obvious that they're missing that. I would use as a case in point of people that are in the Royals Hall of Fame. There's a lot of, if you look at numbers, perhaps, the case of Cookie Rojas would be one that you would say, I don't know if Cookie belongs in the Royals Hall of Fame, but the countervailing point on that would be he was such an, not that they were bad numbers, you know, multiple time all-star with the Royals, but there's also an influence that he had on the formation of those championship teams, of which he was on two, but a lot of those core players that he helped to mentor and everything went on to win several more. It was obviously a key development in the Frank White story, which is an interesting story in and of itself, another Kansas City guy. But, and we remember Frank as being beloved in Kansas City, but he wasn't at the very beginning because Cookie was so popular here in Kansas City and was such a fixture on those teams that Cookie wasn't only beloved by the players that he played with in a lot of cases, but the fans in Kansas City as well. So I think that really helps Cookie's case in getting into the Royals Hall of Fame many, many years ago. So I think, you know, in some respect that some of those cases would have been bolstered by team performance, team getting into the playoffs. Something that I think that'll still be the case in the future too. If once we have teams that are competing for playoff positions, I think some of those players that'll come through in that particular era will have a leg up on some others.
Well, we're talking with Kurt Nelson, director of the Kansas City Royals Hall of Fame. Kurt, you did mention it takes a process and a percentage, and so. The players vote. I don't know if we covered that or not. I remember hearing you talk about it before, but the players get a vote on this, and other people, I assume, get a vote within the organization. Who are some, like, what type of people get a vote on this outside of obviously like the Twitter vote and stuff like that? And there's the players that are the current members of the Hall of Fame. And then who else is part of the voting process on this?
There's 40 overall votes in the regular phase. So there's 40 votes. Three of them will be taken up by the fan vote. So the three will be designated. Whoever wins the fan vote will receive all three. Whoever comes in second will get two of the three, and whoever comes in third will get one of the three. So that's how that'll be divvied up. The other part of the vote is there's 19 living Royals Hall of Famers, and each one of them has a vote. So all of those folks are in there. I would say all the gentlemen, and that's true. There is one lady in the Hall of Fame, but unfortunately she's not with us anymore. So they are all gentlemen. So they all have a vote. Then there's a group of Royals front office personnel that have a vote, and then there's selected members of the media, and some of them are broadcasters. We have some representing everybody. We have some representing print, some representing broadcast, television and radio, and that's basically the makeup of the group that votes on the Royals Hall of Fame. And then it's really in the Veterans Committee portion, it's sort of a subset of that, as designated by the Royals Hall of Fame Executive Board. It's sort of a subset of those 40 would vote on those particular thing in the even numbered years.
And you answered my question about three being for the fans. So is there a limit on how many people can get in each year?
There's a limit on the number of people that, and it's sort of the same. The fans get three votes because the individual electors can vote for up to three names. So the individual elector has the choice of voting for 0, 1, 2, or 3. So there's conceivably you could have three inductees in the same year.
So yeah, to get the correct percentage, it would be three, and that would be the most that it could get in. Mike, did you have anything else?
No, covered. Those are the two names. I love David Cohn when he signed back, and I was always kind of curious about that process. So that was the key one I had.
There's a couple of interesting ones on there because Daryl Porter is a very interesting case because his 1979 season in particular is one of the greatest in Royals history, especially when you consider he's a catcher.
Yeah.
And the stress of catching and to be able to have a year like he had in 79, he had two straight years where he was in the top 10 in the AL MVP voting. You know, 120 some RBIs that year or something like that. I think led the league in walks, which we haven't seen a whole lot of in Royals history. So, I mean, he was a pretty good catcher. So he's an interesting case. I would suppose that one of the drawbacks to him wasn't long enough. Did he have enough impact on Royals history? That's a debate to be had. But that's an interesting case. Bo is a fascinating case because it just depends on if you're a strictly numbers person, you probably say no. If you were to look at it as what I would call overall impact, you might say yes. Both legitimate arguments to be had, but that's an interesting debate to be had, and it's been being had for quite some time now. And obviously he was grandfathered in, so you can tell he was on ballots three election processes before we started this one, and he made it through the 1 in 11, so he got more than 10% of the vote then, so you can tell that he's still there, but he hasn't been inducted. So it goes, he doesn't have, at least so far, hasn't had enough support to get in, but he certainly has had enough support to stay on the ballot and be an interesting case to debate. Al Fitzmaurice is another guy, when you look at the numbers, I think a lot of people don't realize Al had some pretty good numbers back on some of those teams, won 15 games, I believe, on the 76 team. Does he still have the lowest ERA in Royals history, I believe, and so it's, you know, that's an interesting case. From a historian standpoint, I find him interesting because he was taken in the expansion draft, which I'm always fascinated by the guys that were taken in the expansion draft. The other thing that's interesting, and I don't know this to be true, I should do some research on this. I think I even talked to Fitzy about this one time. Fitzy was taken in the expansion draft twice. He was taken by the Royals, and then he was taken by the Toronto Blue Jays. Later on. So I don't think there's been a whole lot of guys that have been taken in two expansion drafts. So there were enough clubs thinking enough of him that he was taken in two expansion drafts. So he's an interesting case too. So there's some interesting debate to be had. And, you know, that's always the problem that I have when I sent the ballots out last week, and, you know, you get on the Twitterverse and it's easy to snark and all that. And I get it. And I've been a Royals fan through that era too. So I understand where some of that comes from. But what's the unfortunate part about that is instead of, you know, spending too much time on the guys that clearly don't deserve your vote as far as to be in the Royals Hall of Fame, it takes away some from the having the legitimate debate between some of the guys that have an interesting case to be made that maybe they ought to be considered. So I wish people would focus on that a little more. But I get the snarky part. I do get it.
What would Twitter be without snark?
It would collapse, wouldn't it?
Right.
I think so, yeah.
Just going back to, this is just a little off note. You had mentioned that you had to be in baseball for 10 years to qualify for the Hall of Fame and how many players there are. Just an example of what players are out there that have played 10 years. All names people probably know, but Derek Jeter, Mariano Rivera, Todd Helton, Jimmy Rollins, Brian Roberts, Chase Utley, and Justin Morneau are the players that are playing today that have at least 10 years of time. And I think out of those, probably the top two are the only two that'll make the Hall of Fame. A couple others might get a look, but like you were saying, you know, that right there is an example of there's 8 guys. So you're getting about a quarter of the guys that are currently playing that would even be, you know, decent guys to look at for the Hall of Fame. So same kind of thing for the Royals Hall of Fame. I'm sure if I had time and could go through and find every player that played here for 3 seasons and met the criteria, the 1,500 plate appearances and 150 innings, it would be quite the list. And out of those, there'd maybe be, you know, a couple, 3 or 4 that would really be interesting over the last 20 years. So hopefully in the next, I shouldn't say the last 20 years, last 10 years, 10, 15 years is probably when the Royals have been in the doldrums. But it'll be interesting to see 10, 15 years from now when we're looking back and we're looking back at the Billy Butlers and the Hosmers and the Moustakas and you know, even you know, people like Hochaver. Can you imagine if his career does end like it's gone so far, the kind of snark that's going to come out the year that Hochaver's eligible for the Royals Hall of Fame? Kyle Davies, there's another one that'll be – you ain't seen snark until that name hits the ballot, I'm sure. So it'll be a lot of fun to look at back and see the players that have came out in the social media era that we have – we're more familiar with the players now than we ever have been because you're always talking on Twitter. You can always talk about the games and the players and what have you. And so it will be interesting. But I appreciate that the Royals do include the fans in this process. So for whatever input you had on that idea, I'm really glad that the Royals do that. Outside of that, I think we're gonna let you go, Kurt. Thank you for coming on, and what'll probably end up being the geekiest episode ever, you know, just talking about Hall of Fame and stuff like that. But it really kind of fits Mike and I. We're two baseball geeks, so it's definitely up our alley. And thank you again for taking almost an hour of your time today to come on with us.
No problem. I always tell people I'm the king of the geeks, and I mean that affectionately because I obviously include myself among them. So I got no problem being called a geek. That's the way it is. But it got me a gig, so I'm a
right.
And my baseball geekdom pays my bills. So anytime you guys need anything, just let me know. I'd be happy to help. So.
I won't be making it out to the K this year because I'm moving to Flagstaff on Monday, but definitely say hello to Casey for me. He is an absolute amazing ambassador to the Hall of Fame. If folks have never been to the Hall of Fame, first off, what are you doing? If you're a Royals fan, you've never been through the Royals Hall of Fame, you're not doing it right. So go take the time. Go out to a ball game at, you know, if you're going to a 7-10 game, go out at 5 at, I guess they open an hour and a half before, so about 5:30, 5:45, get out there, go right to the Hall of Fame, make a beeline for it, and you can spend an hour, hour and a half, and especially on days that are real cold or real hot, it's a great place to start out your night to stay warm or to cool off, and go out there and check it out. And when you get inside the door, you're going to see a gentleman holding a baseball bat in an old school uniform, and ask him anything baseball, and he'll talk to you because he is a brilliant ambassador to what is being done out there with the Hall of Fame. And the folks that work in there are very, very friendly. Some of the friendliest folks that are at the stadium are in that Hall of Fame. So definitely go check it out. Get a tour. I was going to mention this story. Maury Carlson, I actually waited on him when I first moved to Kansas City, and he hooked me up with some tickets and stuff like that. And because of that, we ended up becoming friends. Found out we actually work out in the same gym. We worked out together for a while. Maury's a great guy. He's an older man, but he's young at heart, and he will keep up with anybody out there. And there are some definite great experiences. And there's tours from as low as I think $20 or $30 all the way up to several hundred that include Diamond Club seats. So check them out, and you get a chance to see the press box and some other things. It's a really neat experience. But thanks again, Kurt, for coming on with us.
Thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
Have a good day.
You'll see you later.
Bye. So that was Kurt Nelson from the Royals Hall of Fame. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come right back and wrap up the show, and we'll be right back on the other side.
Hi, this is Ned Baudette for Kelly's Westport Inn. Summertime is here, and that means one thing. Your neighbor's cat sneaks over and craps in your garden. No, of course, I'm just joking. Summer also means my neighbor borrowing your boat trailer and driving it into Smithville Lake, or mosquitoes, or your three-year-old drinking the air conditioner water. Haha, I guess what I'm saying here is that summer means different things to different people. And for 65 years, Kelly's Westport Inn has been a vacation for those summer problems ever since Randall Kelly poured his first frosty draft in 1947. 102 degrees and 99% humidity? Don't worry, Kelly's is air conditioned, and the drinks are as cold as ice. And when the heat breaks, Randall's Rooftop is ready for you to kick back, where you can head downstairs for some of the best live music in town. Summer is different things to different people, but to everyone in Kansas City, Kelly's Westport is your summertime bar. I'm Ned Baudette for Kelly's Westport Inn. We'll leave the taps on for you.
Welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault. Mike, what a great interview that was. I really appreciate Kurt. He's been on the show before in the studio. He was on the show with him and Mike McCartney and the mayor, and I can't remember who the fourth person was on that show.
It was George Toma was the other guy.
I mean, it was an action-packed post-All-Star Game show, and he was in studio with us at 1510, and him and McCartney going back and forth, and I should have brought this up, was freaking classic. Talk about two guys just love what they do and love working with the people they work with. So very fortunate in that aspect.
And you were talking about how, like, what McCartney does or what any of the announcers do is your dream job. It's like, yeah, like, what Kurt does is pretty much what my job would be. That's what I want. I'm going to have to gun for his job.
There you go. Maybe go intern with him one summer or something.
I'm a little old to intern, I think.
Too old. Never too old to follow your dreams, Mike.
That's true. You're right.
You know, and I know it's not, and it wasn't an action-packed interview of anything that's going to affect the Royals this year, but I thought it was funny how you could hear kind of I don't want to say disdain, but that's really what it is, the frustration he has with the snark, because he's trying to do something special, you know, involving the fans, and there's too many of us out there that, and I mean, I was just as bad as everybody else. I voted for Bo, and then I mocked the rest of it.
Yeah.
You know, but, it is silly. When you have Emil Brown and Jimmy Gobble on the ballot, it's silly.
Yeah, Emil Brown actually has a better case than you would think. But it's only because the teams were so bad at that point. Because he led the team in RBIs three straight years.
When it first started out, when this whole thing started out, the voting, he had like 22% of the vote. And I remember I tweeted, I said, if somehow Emil Brown wins the fan vote, y'all, I'm going to be so mad.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. He shouldn't be there, but, you know.
And I guess I should have asked Kurt, because I know the voting is closed, but I didn't want to kind of put him on the spot. But I should have asked him who did win the fan vote. Maybe I'll send him an email and see if he'll tell us that, and we can include it next week. Next week might be an adventure, folks. Let me just jump to that real quick. as I've mentioned probably 100 times in the last 6 weeks, I'm moving to Flagstaff, Arizona. I'm going to be visiting my wife's family at their place for the first time in the history of our relationship, and they live out in BFE, New Mexico, 4 hours away from Albuquerque and of all life. So I'm going to be coming out in the middle of nowhere, and we'll have limited access to internet and those kinds of things this weekend. Hopefully my phone will be working and I can tweet and all those kinds of things, but I won't have any tablet, no computer, none of that. So I will be very limited this coming weekend. We're recording this on the 25th. It'll probably go up the 27th because I'm pretty busy tomorrow with the move. But I will post this on the 27th, and then we would like to have a show a week later, or at least record a show about a week later on the 3rd, probably go up the 4th or 5th. And ideally, by then, I'll be in Flagstaff and should have everything set up. But the 1st is opening day in Arizona, and I want to go and check that out. But Bill Ivey has stepped up and said that we can use his Blog Talk account, which if you guys ever have listened to when Bill and I used to do the Royals-Cardinals show on Monday nights, it'll be something similar to that. It'll be different. It'll sound different than this, and obviously Bill will be involved. And he's a Royals and Cardinals fan. He's one of those people. And and he's going to help us out, possibly help us out with producing the show while I'm getting settled in. So we'll see what happens there. We're going to do our best to get a show out to you. I would say most likely we won't have a guest unless we record something off air, which is possible. We have feelers out to two players, and they've just been very busy with this whole preseason thing and haven't been able to get
this whole fighting for jobs. Come on, priorities.
Because to tell you who we're after, we've sent messages out and got responses from David Lowe and Donnie Joseph, who are both of those guys are in hot fights for jobs right now, and both have options. So there's nothing to say that they'll be with the team, but we have reached out to both of them, and we'll continue to. And after I get down there, I plan on running into Danny Duffy again, so maybe we'll talk to him again. But I think if I get down there and actually hang out with him, I'm not going to be doing it on a Kansas City Baseball Vault type presence. I'm going to be doing it on a Troy Olsen enjoying time with a very cool dude type situation. So, outside of that, Mike, do you have anything to add from the interview or
general? Oh, I'm just tired of spring training and I'm ready for the regular season.
Well, I definitely am too. And at least we've seen some baseball that is getting closer to mattering. We're seeing more full rosters and pitchers in 6-7 innings. And so.
It's close.
It's very exciting. But I think on that note, we're going to get out of here. We'll try to see you in about a week. If not, stick with us. We'll get back to you as soon as we can. Bear with me, and we'll get through everything. But for Michael Engel and Kurt Nelson from the Royals Hall of Fame, I'm Troy Olsen. Have a great week. Enjoy opening day, folks. Get out there. Have a great time. And, I'm going to stop. I almost forgot. We got to do the trivia question. I wanted to do that on the end, not the beginning. So really quick trivia question for you. This is for $10 or more. I'm pretty sure I have a $10 certificate, but if not, I know I have some bigger ones. For $10 to Kelly's Westport Inn, of course, our great sponsor, here's a question for you. And pay attention to the wording. Who is the longest reigning member of the Royals organization? What player has the most time with the Royals organization? There was two guys that were in front of him, and both of those guys were let go this last year. They've signed with in other places. So first off, the first part of the question is, who is the current longest-running member of the Royals organization? And then for bonus points, because you're going to have Google and everything else to figure it out, name the two guys that had more time last year. So it's kind of a two-parter. You got to get the first part right, which is who is the reigning longest member of the organization, and then as the tiebreaker, who are the two guys that had it that left. So
and we're talking players, right?
Players. Not you can't right. say you know, Glass or
George Toma.
I think all these people, yeah, George Toma. I think all these people have been here longer than Dayton Moore and
oh yeah.
our front office staff. So there's Easily. A clue. It's none of Dayton's people, I'll tell you that much. But figure that out, and we'll get you a gift certificate. Now, to be eligible, you have to have liked both the Kansas City Baseball Vault and Kings of Kauffman and RoyalsPodcast.com. Those three things, you have to like all three of those on Facebook, And you need to have followed all three accounts on Twitter, which is Kings of Kaufman, KC Baseball Vault, and Royals Podcast. Follow those three things on Facebook and Twitter. That'll make you eligible. And then email me the question to KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com or RoyalManReport@gmail.com. They both come into the same box. So that's where you do that. And if you got any questions or comments or anything else about the show or anything you want us to talk about, send it in. We'll definitely have time next week to talk about it and talk about it.